This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Vinny. On this segment of the program, we're into employment law, and we're focusing on the Americans with Disabilities Act and the rights of employees with disabilities in the workplace. My guests are employment law attorneys Brian Schwartz, who is an advisor to the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar. Brian has offices in Oakland. My other guest is John Hyland, a partner in the San Francisco law firm of Rukin, Hyland, Doria, and Tyndall. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar of California. Additional funding is provided by the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, the Family Law Section of the State Bar, and the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. And it's great to have you back on the program, Brian.
Thank you.
It's been a while since you've been here. And John, welcome for your first time.
Thank you, Chuck.
It's good to have you here. Let's do this, if you would. What do you mean by disability? What does that mean with respect to the Americans with Disabilities Act?
Thanks, Chuck. This is a question that used to be heavily litigated, is whether somebody had a disability or not. And fortunately, the ADA Amendments Act back in 2008 change that largely on the federal level to greatly expand reestablish the definition of disability as a broad one that really favors expansive coverage for people. And then in California, we've always had a very expansive definition of disability that covers lots of people in the workplace. And actually, there's very helpful, and I'll probably mention these during the program, but very helpful new disability regulations in California that were promulgated by the Fair Employment and Housing Council that adopted them, that they just became effective earlier this year. And they're available online at dfeh.ca.gov, Fair Employment and Housing Council regulations. And they talk about what a disability is. But in California, it can be a physical or a mental disability that affects a body system, which could be neurological, it could be musculoskeletal, it could be a system, and it limits a major life activity.
Mm-hmm.
There's a slightly different definition. It's something that substantially limits a major life activity. But then both in California and federally, there's a whole list of conditions which are presumed to be disabilities, which are things like multiple sclerosis or HIV/AIDS or hepatitis. So there's a list of presumed disabilities as well.
When would you be using the federal definition of disability versus the state definition? How would that come about?
Well, usually you're going to be, for most of the listeners, they're going to be using a state definition because the state definition continues to be somewhat more expansive. So if you're a worker in California, then you're going to be invoking that definition. But there are instances where you have to be in federal court and pursuing federal legal remedies under mm-hmm, the ADA mm-hmm, mm-hmm. or the Rehabilitation Act, which is what covers federal employees. So that's where you'll be using the federal definition. But in both cases, it's now a very broad definition, and the statutes and the regulations that have come about over the last 5 years or so encompass a lot of things that had been knocked out gradually by different cases that came up. For example, people who have mitigating measures, like they take certain medication, and when they're on the medication, they don't manifest signs of a disability. There was a period of time when the courts were saying those people were not covered and not protected. Now,
because they were taking the medication,
right? Because the mitigating measures. Now those people are once again protected. Mm-hmm. There was a period of time where courts might have said that if your disability was something that was episodic, in other words, it's only certain times that you have this condition, that you would not be covered. Now people are covered if they are limited in one of those major life activities, even on an episodic basis. Mm-hmm. So, and there's more to it than that, but that's the big picture.
Now, let me ask you this. There's something called the interactive process. And what does that mean? And what happens, John? What does that mean?
Well, the interactive process is it's a process mandated by law, which essentially aims at trying to get the employer and the employee to figure out what is it that the employee needs, what is it that the employer can provide to help them perform the essential functions? And in the background, of course, is the medical provider mm-hmm. who's offering his or her assessment of what the condition is, what's the severity of it, what are the limitations and restrictions. And from there, the employer and the employee who have better knowledge of the job, the workplace, the technology, they engage in a back and forth trying to explore to figure out, is there something we can do to enable you to do the job?
As I understand it, the employee, however, if there's going to be a reasonable accommodation, has to take the initiative and say to the employer, you know what would help me to do this job adequately? I need this, that, or the other. Like if you've got a back problem, you have some kind of a platform that raises, let's say, your computer up. If you're standing, if you can do the job better standing, you have some kind of a platform that raises the computer up so you can be standing using the computer. That would be an accommodation, would it not?
That's correct. And I think certainly the law envisions that it would be the employee in an ideal situation who mm-hmm. would come to his or her boss, the HR manager, and let them know that they are having some difficulty performing their job mm-hmm. and that they could use some type of assistance. But it is not – what we're seeing is the courts are interpreting the regulations to impose upon the employer – a much more stringent obligation to read into the difficulty. And if you are aware that the employee has a condition that might be affecting his or her job performance, even if the employee hasn't raised the issue, it may be the burden may be on the employer to initiate the dialogue.
Because the employee may not raise the issue thinking that if I raise this issue, maybe I'm going to be demoted, maybe I'm going to be fired, et cetera, et cetera. Tell me if I'm wrong on
that's
that.
That's right. Yeah, sometimes people are afraid to bring it up, particularly in certain workplaces. But, there's to add to what John is saying, which is all correct, the crux of it is whether or not the employers become aware of the employee's mm-hmm. need for assistance in the workplace, and that could be because the employee brings it up in some way, not necessarily using magic words like a reasonable accommodation. Mm-hmm. If employers should never really get too hung up on the terminology of the employee said they needed assistance, but they didn't officially ask for an accommodation or officially fill out our form.
The magic words.
Yeah,
the employee
no,
didn't use the magic words.
There's no
therefore.
Magic words. It's about observing the need for assistance.
Yeah.
And sometimes it could be through observation. Sometimes it could be through hearing from it about it through a third party like a doctor or even a coworker. But sometimes it's just because the employee's leave is expiring under the FMLA, the Family
FMLA is what?
The Family Medical Leave Act,
okay.
Which, a lot of employees know, you can get 12 weeks off through that.
Without pay?
Without pay for that. Mm-hmm. But then there's something called the California Family Rights Act, the CFRA, CFRA. So, through this whole process, you get a period of time off, 16 weeks in California. If the employer is aware that at the end of that, the employee might still ultimately be able to perform the essential functions of his or her job through some additional time off, then that might trigger a need for additional interactive process.
The ADA, does it apply to employers who employ so many employees?
Yes.
And what is that?
The ADA is 15 or more.
I see.
And the California Fair Employment and Housing Act, which is the California counterpart, is 5 or more.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And if I could follow up on a point that Brian was raising,
please.
One of the difficulties in imposing upon the employer the obligation to initiate the process if they become aware that the employee may need an accommodation is there's also a prong of the disability laws that protects people who are perceived as disabled.
Mm-hmm.
So as an employer, I may be caught in this difficult situation of, on the one hand, I see you struggling, and I recognize that perhaps this results from a condition that I know you have. But if I approach you to try to initiate this process, dependent upon your response, I could now be found to have discriminated against you by perceiving you as disabled.
Wow.
If, for example, you were to say, well, I'm not disabled. That's not what's causing my work difficulty. And mm-hmm. by the way, why is it that you presume that this difficulty I'm having results from this physical or mental condition I have?
So
it's a real difficult thing for employers to try to balance.
What do you advise your clients how to deal with that? I mean, that's really...
My advice to clients is always to if you're aware of this, talk with the employee, talk with them using open-ended questions, give them every opportunity to tell you that this is what's going on. I mean, it often starts as simple as asking somebody, hey, look, Brian, I know you're struggling with this. What's going on? Is there anything we can do for you? That, most of the time, will get the employee talking enough to be able to address the issue.
And from the perspective of somebody representing workers, I don't look at this process in any way as kind of a gotcha. It's more about the good faith, the timeliness of it, and really the it's called the interactive process. It's the interactiveness of it. It's the employer really going through an individualized assessment with that worker and trying to help figure out how can we make this work so this person can do the essential functions of his or her
job. Do you find, both of you today, do you find still that employees are very reluctant, especially in this economic market where people have lost their jobs or there's not the employment market that there was prior to, 2008 or whatever it was. Are you finding still today that some employees or some percentage of employees are very reluctant to really kind of open up and want to get involved in the interactive process? John?
Yeah, my experience has been it's like with a lot of things in society, there's a stratification. There's a very small percentage, perhaps, in my experience, who are reluctant to raise it, try to shy away from it at all costs, want to keep it concealed. And then at the other end, you have a group of employees who are using it, who are, you know, they understand that this is, to be blunt, a ticket to enable them to oftentimes to get a pass on issues and problems that they otherwise wouldn't be tolerated in the workplace.
If an employee has a disability that would fall within the definition of disability either under the California Act or the ADA, and that employee is terminated by the employer, what is the sanction? What can an employee do in that kind of a situation if that happens? Or is this so unusual today, Brian, that this question is really not that relevant?
Well, it's not just that, you know, somebody, I think the way you phrased it is that somebody has a disability and gets terminated. I mean, people with disabilities get terminated the same as anybody else in the workplace. I think it's more the question of if somebody gets terminated because of the breakdown of the interactive process, because, you know, they're perceived as or they're in fact unable to do the essential functions of their job, and they're not being provided an accommodation. So then they're terminated because they're not doing those functions.
That's essentially my question.
Right.
Yes.
Well, you know, that could be problematic, but it is a very case by case kind of assessment. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to look at where that interactive process broke down. And frankly, from both sides, I think from the perspective of somebody representing employees, but I would also think from the perspective of employers, you don't want to be the party responsible for the interactive process breaking down. Mm-hmm. You want to keep that discussion going in good faith until you've really figured out, is there a way to make it work? Sometimes, and though responding to what you were saying earlier, there's a fear of retaliation certainly that exists. On the other hand, workers' rights are so much more, I think, in the context of disability, robust than they once were. And the ability to accommodate is so much more vibrant now with the kinds of new accommodations that are available to workers in, you know, given all of the modern technologies that exist.
Yeah, it you know, we're a long way away from installing wheelchair ramps and some of the more basic things that were the, I guess, kind of the low-hanging fruit after the ADA were passed.
Yes.
Now we're into things like telecommuting, voice-activated software. A big one that is actually going to become a kind of an interesting issue is assistive animals. There is now a real focus on allowing people to bring into the workplace animals who are not just for people who have trouble seeing or who are blind, but people who have, for example, a depressive disorder or some other type of mental disorder for whom they have a healthcare provider who says that the Pekingese you carry around or the Shih Tzu you carry around provides a form of stress relief, and you need, employer, to consider whether or not you need that as an accommodation. You have to allow that person to bring the animal
to work.
That's
very interesting.
And it's a big focus now of the of the California regs as well as under the
That is very interesting. What if someone has a cat, and I'm not being facetious, I'm being serious about this. What if someone has a cat who has provided the kind of assistance for someone who does have a depressive problem? Is that going to be available to that person to bring the cat into the office?
I've seen that exact
Have
issue.
You?
Yeah, and it's
really?
the three things that you're looking at primarily. Once you make a determination that, in fact, the person does have a condition for which this is a form of accommodation that enables them to deal with their disorder, you have to look at, one, is the animal housebroken, for lack of a better term?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's...
and the regulations actually specify that.
Sure,
thankfully, they recognize that can be a problem in most workplaces. Secondly, is going to be the impact in the workplace, the smell, or the and I'm assuming allergens is going to be another thing. So, you know, one person might need their cat as a form of stress relief, and another person might be highly allergic to cats. So I think
that's a problem. Sure.
It's going to take a bit to get this settled. But and I don't think we're going to see an influx of animals taking over the workplace. But I do think that people are going to, you know, find reasons to bring them in.
Well,
I think,
it's certainly fascinating.
I think what it highlights, though, Chuck, is that if you have a lawyer like John here, or, you know, who's undergoing this kind of analysis and this individualized assessment and looking at this exact situation that we have here in the workplace, and can we address it in this way, then employers are going to be okay and employees are going to feel like they're getting accommodated. If you have an employer who just has a sort of a blanket policy, this is our policy, this is how we're doing it, I'm not going to look at this situation, I'm not going to treat this person any specially or any differently, that's where employers run into problems. That's where employees wind up calling a lawyer like me. One of the interesting accommodations issues that comes up a lot, Chuck, is where for whatever reason, the employee can no longer do the essential functions of his or her job that they had, that he or she had before, and so the only accommodation available would be to be reassigned to a different position, and that's that is something that we see a lot, you know, particularly for workers who have jobs that are very physical, and maybe they, you know, they have a terrible back problem, they just can't do, you know, a nurse who can no longer lift those patients in the same way, but they work for a hospital chain, and they can do, with their nursing background and their science background and so forth, they can do many other jobs in the workplace. So reassignment as an accommodation is something that is neat that employers need to look at. And I think in the past there was a discussion about, well, does the duty to reassign is it an affirmative duty that an employer has? And does it mean that the employee gets special consideration, or do they have to compete for those jobs, or do they, you know, they wind up on a list for those jobs? And the answer has evolved to be, and is very clearly now, the employer has that affirmative obligation to seek that reassignment for the worker if that's
and
the only accommodation.
And can bump other people.
It's not a matter. It's not about bumping, Chuck. It's about if you have a job that is vacant, that employee does not have to compete for the job.
I see.
As though they're applying off the streets, but, you know, has the right to be accommodated in that position to which they could be reassigned, that they're that he or she is qualified.
Let me throw something out to you then. With reassignment, the duty of the employer to deal with the problem by reassigning the worker. Does the worker have to still get the same salary that the worker did have in this as the reassignment takes place, or if the reassignment is not of the same level of, let's say, responsibility, et cetera, is it all right that the reassignment can be to a position that the employee can do, but it would be at a lesser salary?
Right. Well, and the answer is that it's you know, you're going to have to look case by case, but as a general policy matter, the employee should be reassigned to a comparable position if one is available. It's certainly not necessarily an opportunity for promotion, or doesn't need to be. That's not the employer's obligation, but a comparable position if one is available. If none are available, and then again, you're looking at how big is this employer, because if it's a really big employer, there probably is a comparable position available. Yeah. But if there's none that's available, then you look at, you know, you can look at other positions in the workplace that would you know, enable that employee to perform the essential functions. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that, oh, you know, this is an employee making 70 grand a year doing some, you know, professional kind of capacity and they can no longer do that. So we're going to, you know, have them sweeping floors. Not that there's anything wrong with sweeping floors, you know, if this is an employee who's, you know, doing skilled nursing, going back to that example, you can't just kind of shuttle them off to the most menial job in the workforce at that point and try to push them out the door. You know, you should be trying to find that mm-hmm. comparable position as an employer. And then if that position is not available, then you'd find another one that person's qualified for that they want to do.
Well, let me let everybody know what's going on here. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're talking about the Americans with Disabilities Act and the rights of employees with disabilities in the workplace. For those of you who listen to us live, whether it's in the Bay Area or on the internet at www.kalw.org, in a few minutes, I'll give our local phone number, and if you have questions in the employment law area, please feel free to call in. So be patient if you would. My guests are John Hyland and Brian Schwartz. They're both members of the Labor and Employment Law section of the State Bar. Brian is currently an advisor. You were formerly on the executive committee, weren't you, Brian?
Yeah, and then they retire us after.
Yeah, they couldn't take it anymore.
Right.
They thought, let's reassign him.
I got termed out.
That's right.
Brian Schwartz has offices in in Oakland, pardon me. And John Hyland is a partner in the San Francisco law firm of Rukin, Hyland, Doria, and Tyndall. And so they're both very experienced in this area of disability law. Also, if you do want to call in the second half hour, certainly there are questions that you may have in other areas of employment law. Don't feel embarrassed to ask them, because that's the whole point. In this situation now, where our economy is still very depressed, I believe, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but everything I hear, everything I read, it's still very depressed, although what was the most recent report was our unemployment percentages. What is it? Do you have the figure?
I don't know, Chuck. I think we're rebounding. Better. I think we're rebounding.
We're rebounding a little bit, not a lot. What about the situation if someone's applying for a job? What can that person who may have a disability expect that he or she is going to be questioned about regarding a disability, if at all? And is that person going to be possibly subjected to a pre-employment medical exam?
I'd say this is one of the few areas in disability law where there is some clarity, or at least some certainty. With respect to the interview process or the applications, you cannot ask employee or applicants, candidates, about their medical history, mm-hmm. disabilities, workplace injuries that they've sustained with prior employers. The only exception to that is if the person has an obvious disability, mm-hmm. then I think what the
if
law
is. If someone is limping, for example, as an example, if you see someone, as an employer, see someone coming into the employer's office for the pre-employment interview, that person is limping, that's pretty obvious.
Yeah.
Something's happened there.
It might have to be even more obvious than that, because I think a limp, somebody could have twisted their ankle, in which case you might be setting yourself up for the presumed disabled or perceived disabled. So
the employer has
sort of
to
a wheelchair,
walk on eggshells.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Right. So I think generally the rules are, from an employer's perspective, is you don't ask anything about health issues, medical conditions, mm-hmm. et cetera, during the interview process. Despite the clarity, there are still many examples you see where somebody does ask flat out the question, are you disabled? Mm-hmm. Have you ever filed a workers' comp injuries or anything mm-hmm. about your health that's going to...
And that is not permitted, generally speaking.
Correct.
What if the employer does that? How should the employee respond to a question like that?
Yeah, and that's a difficult one to answer. I mean, on the one hand, I think the... From a legal perspective, the candidate, the applicant, could say, well, mm-hmm. I'd prefer not to answer that. And I'm sure that they might have a way to diplomatically defer answering mm-hmm. it. But I think you also recognize the reality. You're sitting in a interview hoping to get a job and somebody asks you a question, dodging the answer is generally not good advice for trying to get a job. So I think it creates a bit of a difficult situation for the applicant, the interviewee. And what you see, I think a lot of interviewers have gotten skilled at getting to the information they want without asking the question directly. So they may look to a gap on somebody's employment record, try to get to the bottom of why there is that gap, what happened, and lo and behold, it may have been due to some kind of a health issue. They can ask questions in a lot of different ways.
What were you doing between this year and this year? You have nothing down on your resume here.
But, John, is that a – I mean, is it a – I hear what you're saying. Is it a good idea, though, for an employer to try to elicit information like that? I mean, isn't that just going to put an employer in a bad spot? I mean, you don't want to be – don't you want to not be thinking about that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it's a well-advised employer is not only not asking the questions, not asking those questions that might elicit that kind of information because you don't want that information, but also learning how to quickly shut down any line of discussion that could raise that information. Because from the employer's perspective, you don't want that information because if you pass this candidate over, you don't want to have sitting on your lap the knowledge that they had this health issue because that would suggest or may suggest to the person that the reason you passed me over was because I revealed to you whatever condition.
And that would be a basis for discrimination and possibly a lawsuit if an employee had this in mind.
That's right.
Or prospective employee, I should say.
And Chuck, I would give a shout out again to these new regulations dfeh.ca.gov from the Fair Employment and Housing Council because they actually have a list of examples of prohibited inquiries. They just, you know, run through, don't ask this, don't ask that, which is extremely, I would think, extremely helpful if you're like John and I are employers of our own small businesses. I mean, it's good to know these things. What are you not supposed to ask? I mean, there's a whole list here.
Let's have that website again slowly, if you would.
Yeah, sorry about that. It's DFEH, which stands for the Department of Fair Employment and Housing, .ca.gov.
Okay,
and then it's
good.
/Fair Employment and Housing Council.
Ah, okay. / Fair Employment and Housing Council.
Yeah, .htm. So if you just look up disability regs, DFEH, these are going to pop up.
And while we're on resources, I would point people to the EEOC's website. They have a very user-friendly question and answer.
This is the federal one?
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's just EEOC.gov. They have a lot of helpful information there in the question and answer format.
Well, that's very good. Okay, that's very good. We, by the way, have come to the end of the statewide version of the program. And so it is, by the way, about 7:28 at 91.7. I nearly went over the border here, nearly went off the cliff. This was getting so interesting. But we're in time. Okay, so those of you who have questions that you would like to ask of my guests, the number is 1-415-841-4134, 1-415-841-4134. This is Your Legal Rights if you tuned in the last few minutes. I'm Chuck Finney. My guests are employment law attorneys Brian Schwartz and John Hyland. Brian is an advisor to the Labor and Employment Law Section. He was formerly very, very helpful to me in recent years as being my contact to the Labor and Employment Law Section, which is a major funder of this program with his suggestion of topics and guests. They decided he was just too good. And they said, you can't do it anymore. We don't want you to help Finney anymore like this. No, I'm just joking, everybody. And Bryant has offices in Oakland. My other guest is John Hyland. This is John's first time on Your Legal Rights. He's a partner in the San Francisco law firm of Rukin, Hyland, Doria, and Tyndall. And for those of you who are interested, we will have our next Call a Lawyer night, not on Thanksgiving Eve, which would be the last Wednesday of the month. We're not going to do that. We're going to have it on November 20th. And so in case you're interested and you want to talk to attorneys off the air, with no obligation whatsoever, when we have certified specialists and other attorneys, That'll be on Wednesday evening, November 20th. You might want to jot down the number, 1-800-525-9917. So let me do this. Let me just suggest to you that if you have a question about employment law, whether it's in the area of the Americans with Disabilities Act or have some other question about employment law, whether you're an employee or an employer, please feel comfortable in calling in and asking the question or making the comment to my guest, 1-415-841-4134. Let me just mention a couple of things to you that I'd like you to know actually that are going on. Tomorrow at the San Mateo County Law Library, which is in Redwood City across the street from my office, the Law Library is going to have a presentation on in-depth the basics of declaring bankruptcy. This will be at noon tomorrow at 710 Hamilton Street in Redwood City. It's a free presentation, a lecture by attorney Matthew Grech, G-R-E-C-H. And you can bring your box lunch or your bag lunch and enjoy this from noon till 1. If you'd like more information before noon tomorrow, the number to call is 650-363-4913, 650-363-4913. Also, coming up on actually November 17th, that's a Sunday, I want to let you know about this also. It's the third annual Art of Financial Well-Being Resource Fair, which is put on by the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. And that's going to be on Sunday, November 17th, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. They will have workshops in a number of areas. The Affordable Care Act, which, by the way, we are doing next week, focusing on businesses and employees in businesses and how the Affordable Care Act applies to them and how Covered California may apply. At the workshop on the 17th, they're going to talk about financial aspects of marital and non-marital partnerships, long-term care insurance, Medicare, and Social Security. And so I'll announce that again next week, but that's going to be on November 17th. And then again tomorrow, November 7th, is going to be the basics of declaring bankruptcy. So, all right, some people are calling in now. I have a question that was brought into the studio here by Martin. And let me read this to you. It's a little bit lengthy, but I'll try to do my best. I am an employee with a business that operates several blood draw stations. People are referred by examining doctors who have blood drawn for diagnostic purposes. I am in decent health, wear a prescription eyeglass, and I have effects of seasonal allergies. Not much of a disability. However, there are frequently days when I am the only person on duty and the stresses resulting wear me down and affect my attitude. In short, I feel overextended, and I have to ask, what is a reasonable accommodation? Is this job wearing me out? Am I protected in this overexposed work slot? And what help is ADA to someone in this predicament, or are there remedies other than ADA? Thank you. How about that? What do you say, John?
You know, this is an issue that comes up frequently, which is the stress of a job is causing the person to feel as though they are disabled.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So the first question is this normal workplace stress, or is it stress that has arisen to the level of a disability? So if it has risen to the level of a disability, then we would go through the process that we talked about, which would be getting the medical certification that there is a condition, what are the limitations and restrictions, and from there, going into the interactive process. One of the most difficult aspects, though, of dealing with stress-related disabilities is ultimately what the employee may be asking for is to reduce or eliminate the stress in my job.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, is inherent in just about every job.
Yes.
So The short answer is, if it's just normal workplace stress, you can talk with your manager. You can try to deal with this as a non-legal issue and hope to get some remedy that way. But if it's just work-related stress that hasn't caused a disability, you're probably not going to be entitled to an accommodation.
The thing this question includes, though, is this person says, when I am alone, it sounds like at other times there's more, there's someone else there working with him on duty with him or her. I don't know whether this is a man or a woman. And it sounds, are there times when there may be so much pressure on an employee who may be doing a job that an employer may have as a reasonable accommodation to have a second employee work in that with that person, or is that going too far?
Generally, that's not going to be required, because to the extent that the that would be having the essential functions of the job. I mean, you would be saying, I'm taking one job, perhaps,
and
splitting
and dividing it up.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I see.
The other thing for the person to consider is where you have a disorder or a disability caused by workplace stress, it may be a workers' comp injury.
Or
maybe a workers' comp
issue.
So you do see a lot of that. I do know that workers' comp carriers are particularly skeptical of work-related or stress-related workplace injuries, but they do exist and they are compensable.
Jim, let me, or pardon me, I don't know the name of this person on this question, but let me suggest to you, we are, in a couple of weeks, as I said, we will do our Call a Lawyer night, and Alice O'Sullivan will be here, who's a certified specialist in workers' comp. Maybe you want to, if you can wait until November 20th, and during from 7 to 8, plan to call in and speak with Alice and see if she might have some suggestion for you as to whether or not this might be something that you might want to look into as far as workers' compensation. All right, let's do this. Jim, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure, of course.
I'm wondering if migraine headaches are considered a workplace disability, and if they are, what's the employer's obligation?
That's a good question, and I had a case, a migraine headache case years ago, and this is an area where the revisions to the ADA were a big help on the federal level, because migraines are an example of a type of condition which for most people is episodic and, you know, goes into remission from time to time. And what the ADA now provides is that if your migraines substantially limit you when they are occurring, that they can be considered a disability if they're impairing one of your major life activities, like your ability to concentrate or your ability to interact with other people or to, you know, be in ordinary amounts of light or darkness. So, and then in California, I think migraines almost certainly would be covered if they're you know, serious migraines, because they would tend to affect one of your bodily symptom, bodily systems, like your neurological system, your ability to think, or your maybe your circulatory system might be affected by you know, the blood flow, or you know, I'm not a medical expert, obviously, but there are any number of bodily systems that might be affected by serious migraines, and then of course it could limit a major life activity like concentrating or speaking or any number of things. So if you have migraines and they're at that level, and even if they can be controlled with medications and things, again, you look at it not as it is addressed through assistive medication mitigating measures, but you look at it as it would be without that. And then it would be considered a protected disability, and then you might be entitled to certain types of accommodations if there are certain things. For example, you might see a situation where there's a copy machine that has bright lights that are flashing very frequently, and your office is adjacent to that, or across directly across from the office that has copy machine with flashing bright lights, and that might trigger migraines for you. It might be a reasonable accommodation to either move the copier or for you to be moved to another location if there's one available where you wouldn't be exposed to that kind of light. Or it might be a reasonable accommodation to if you need to lie down on the floor of your office and turn out the lights for some brief period of time periodically to relieve yourself of that condition. So there's any number of types of accommodations that might apply in the migraine context.
Jim, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
You know, one of the things that I would ask both of you with respect to the kind of question that Jim just asked is this. With Jim having this problem and not knowing, obviously, what he should do or whether or not he should get into some kind of an interactive process with the employer, Do you suggest that it makes sense for him or people who have questions like this to want to contact their Bar Association lawyer referral panels and see if they can have an appointment with an employment law attorney and discuss what the employment law attorney has to say? Or is this area of the ADA so specific that many employment law attorneys are really not that well-versed in what someone might do? I'm interested in your comments, Brian.
Well, I'm interested. Obviously, John might have a different take. But, I mean, first of all, I think you should probably give the employer a chance to do the right thing before contacting any attorney on something like this. I mean, mm-hmm. Indicating, if needed, the need for assistance in the workplace. Say, you know, these migraines make it really difficult. And I think if you just moved the copier into that empty room right there and plugged it in, I might be just fine. But that seemed, my doctor says that's triggering these headaches. And if the employer is, you know, well advised by somebody like John, then they're going to do the right thing and continue that interactive process.
Mm-hmm. Any comments from you, John?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think that the migraines is a good example because for the most part, people who suffer from migraines are the best person to assess what is it that triggers mm-hmm. this, what mm-hmm. can I do to alleviate it. So mm-hmm. that would be a good mm-hmm. starting point.
Okay, very good. All right. Daris, welcome to your legal rights. Daris, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm having a question regarding California's at-will employment. I was on a job for 5 months, and during those 5 months, I never got any indication from my employer that I was not doing a good job or anything of that nature. I was showing up for work on time every day, and then all of a sudden, they terminated my employment and said that they needed no reason to give me for that termination. And I heard a lot about the at-will employment. I just want to know, as a worker, do I have any type of respite to fight that?
What kind of work were you doing, Daris?
What kind of work? Property management.
Pardon me?
Property management?
I see.
Yes.
What do you have to say about that, John?
Well, I think the short answer is that they're right that you are, in all likelihood, employed at will, which is a statutory presumption in California and in mm-hmm. nearly every other state. And really what that means is the employer has the right to terminate you for any reason at all, good reason, bad reason, no reason at all, subject to, however, significant limitations. You can't terminate somebody because of their race, their national origin, their disability status. So it's not truly at will. I don't know enough about the employer or the circumstances, but it's been my experience that when an employer doesn't provide some reason mm-hmm. And instead reverts to the, well, I'm firing you because I can, there may be something more going on. So the real question is, why is it that they terminated me? And is that reason merely a bad reason, or has it crossed the line and become an unlawful reason?
What county are you in, Daris?
I didn't hear you.
What county are you in?
Alameda County.
Alameda County. You know, my suggestion, frankly, on this also, because I'm a real believer in people trying to educate themselves. I take it you have not talked to an attorney about this. Is that right?
Not as of yet.
Yeah.
Because the company is giving me 14 days to sign an agreement saying that, and if I sign the agreement, then they won't, they'll give me my unemployment benefits, but if I don't sign it, then they won't give me the unemployment benefits.
Hmm. You know, I would suggest to you, you might want to contact the Alameda County Bar Association Lawyer Referral Service. You want to jot this number down?
Yes.
Before you sign anything, in my opinion, you need to get some advice from an employment lawyer who represents employees, and maybe my guests will have some other thoughts. But here it is, the Alameda County Bar.
Mm-hmm.
I think this goes directly to lawyer referral, but this is at least to the Alameda County Bar. You want to ask for the lawyer referral. You want to tell them, I'm an employee. I'm facing being fired. I'd like to speak to an employment law attorney who represents employees. Here's the number, 510.
Okay. Uh-huh.
302-2222.
Okay.
And for a half an hour consultation, it'll probably cost you $35. That doesn't go to the lawyer. It goes to the referral service as a consumer service. I think it's important that you try to get some education in this thing before you sign anything. So good luck to you.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Also, let me mention this to everybody. Support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco, and if you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The San Francisco Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. For a referral to a lawyer, you can call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. The Lawyer Referral Service is also a funder of this program and of this station. In addition, if you're in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar Association also has a Lawyer Referral Service. That number, 650-369-4149. The San Mateo County Bar Association also funds this program. If you're in any other county in California, every county has a bar association and a lawyer referral service. You can call your own, tell them what the problem is. They'll do their best to try to find someone for you who's experienced in the area that you're having the problem in. They'll set you up for a half an hour consultation. And in most counties throughout California, for half an hour, it could be a low of $25, maybe a high of $35. It's a great way to try to get some basic experience or at least some learning in what you're confronted with. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're talking about employment law. We've been talking about the Americans with Disabilities Act. If you have other questions in the area of employment law, whether it's the ADA or other areas of difficulties, whether you're an employee or an employer, the number 1415-841-4134. 1415-841-4134. My guests are employment law attorneys, very experienced, Brian Schwartz and John Hyland. And we've got Ronnie. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi there. This is Ronnie.
Hi.
Hi, I want to tag on to what Mr. Darris was just saying as far as at-will employment. Just Friday, I was terminated and told that it was just not a good fit. My work was great, and if I go by my instincts, I've worked a long time. It is because I had requested and kept pushing to get an ergonomic chair.
Oh.
And I believe this really irritated people, but it took 3-4 months to get a chair.
Well, you finally got the chair?
I finally got the chair and then went on vacation and came back and got terminated. So it was like, we're going to give you your chair, but...
How long had you had the chair before they terminated you?
Less than a month, about 2 to 3 weeks.
And how long had you been with this employer?
I had been with them since June 3rd. Got terminated November...
Of this year? June 3rd of this year?
Yes.
I see.
It wasn't that long, but mm-hmm. It was like within the first week I realized I needed a chair, that their chairs, and I was told I needed a doctor's note in order to get a chair. I brought that in just a couple of weeks later because I had to wait for the medical to kick in. And then when the chairs finally came in, they ordered 13 of them. Everyone got chairs, and I still hadn't gotten one. So I ended up having to call over my boss's head, and an hour later I got a chair, and he got very angry about
it. Yeah, I can see that. I can see that your boss would be.
My bottom line was I really needed a chair.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the doctor's note made it real clear. I have one fake hip or prosthesis. I have arthritis in my back. Their chairs had no back support. I had to sit on ice in order to sit on their chairs.
But, Ronnie, you're saying that the employer ordered several chairs for people, other people, but not for you initially. Yeah. Is that right?
It's
very strange.
It's a little longer story. I ended up having to talk to their workman's comp person.
Oh.
I talked to their ergo doctor in Georgia.
Yeah.
I went and picked out the chair.
Yeah.
I had to go to the warehouse or whatever and pick out the chair. And then after the ergo guy, the workman's comp guy came in and sat in the chair, that's when the project for 13 chairs came up.
Really? That's interesting. Ronnie, without saying who the employer is, was this a large employer?
Yes.
It was. Okay.
Yes.
What comments do you have? Is it Ronnie or Lonnie?
Ronnie, with an R.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Ronnie, what comments do you have for Ronnie, John?
Your initial assessment that it sounds like they were angry at you for pushing for the chair certainly fits within the mold of a retaliation for somebody who exercises their right to request an accommodation. What makes it a little puzzling, and obviously there's a lot of facts we don't know, Ronnie, but what makes it puzzling is that the employer purchased a number of these and did, in fact, give you the chair. And then,
only, though, after she personally ordered it. They didn't order the chair for her in the group that they got.
Well, more importantly, they weren't ordering a whole bunch of chairs until the guy who does workman's comp came up.
Oh,
I see.
With me, and then I asked him to sit in the chair, and he almost went all the way back. And then when he got up, he said, you know, okay, well, let me go and talk to the boss for a minute. And the next thing I know, like a week later, there's a project online for 13 ergo chairs. So I know the workman's comp guy sat in it. I mean, you could read it all over his face.
I think, Ronnie, what happened here is the employer realized Ronnie's a troublemaker. That's what I think happened, unfortunately. But that doesn't mean you don't have some rights. Mm-hmm. What do you say, John?
Well, if it was... if this would have qualified as a form of accommodation, if you had the medical documentation, if you had a medical condition for which this was the an accommodation that would enable you to perform the functions of your job, and you requested it, and they ultimately gave it to you, the company gave it to you, but then your manager was angry at you for pushing it, that would or could qualify as unlawful retaliation.
Yeah. Yeah. What county are you in, Ronnie?
I'm in Alameda.
Yeah. Well, did you get the phone number for the Alameda County Bar? You did get it.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, I think you need to see an employment law attorney also.
Yeah.
Yeah, do it.
I have to. And not just because, I mean, it's not just for me. They got to know that this just doesn't work. And it wasn't like I was asking for a wheelchair ramp to go up 3 stories.
Yeah, right.
You know, it was just a chair.
Well, good luck to you.
Okay, thank you.
Take care. Glad you called. All right, this is our next caller. Berha?
Yes, sir.
Berha, hi. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me with you.
Of course. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have a trouble with my coworker. You know, I have a diabetes, and then I just give them a lot of doctor notes, just the what they have to provide me, their accommodation. What I'm asking, it doesn't hurt them. It doesn't cost them any penny. The only thing is to check my sugar, to eat as needed, and then I have a gout or so, occasionally sitting. But now, just recently, they say no sitting, no eating, all this, and don't bring the machine, any kind of machine at work. That makes me very, very, very uncomfortable.
Berha, let me get Brian to respond to you. And have you seen an attorney yet?
No.
Yeah, okay. That's what I thought. Go ahead. Brian, please.
Well, Berha, without knowing all of the facts, it does sound problematic because this employer sounds like it is doing what John and I were saying an employer should not do, which is sort of making blanket statements about we don't do this, we don't do that, instead of undergoing some kind of an interactive process with you about your need for assistance in the workplace based on your disability. So certainly the kinds of things that you were identifying as needed accommodations, eating something periodically, being able to sit down periodically, are the kinds of accommodations that are typically reasonable. I mean, there are exceptions to everything. If you worked in some kind of nuclear clean room facility, you know, where it would, you know, cause some major catastrophe if food came into the environment and you couldn't get out. I mean, it's conceivable a situation where it would be unreasonable or an undue hardship to allow somebody to have food in the workplace. But it would be, I think, the exception. And so ordinarily the kinds of accommodations that you're talking about are the kinds of accommodations that would be reasonable accommodations that an employer would have an obligation to provide and certainly to talk to you about through this interactive process. So I think, as Chuck said, you might want to talk to an attorney if they are not providing those accommodations. But you could help yourself, too, by using some of the language that we've been using on this program and kind of let them know that you know what your rights are. That might scare them into paying more attention to what you're saying to them.
What county are you in, Berha?
San Francisco. I wrote them a letter just recently, 4 days ago. I wrote them a letter, let them understand that they are violating. I do the job like other my coworkers to do. I never just, you know, this is the only accommodation I need. There is no anything.
What county are you in, Berha?
San Francisco.
Yeah. I think you should also consider at this point, since obviously this sounds like it's a real becoming a real problem for you, I think you should contact the Lawyer Referral Service for the Bar Association of San Francisco. Did you get that number?
Yes, I do.
Did you get it? Okay. Well, thank you very much for calling.
Thank you.
Good luck to you. I hope contact the Lawyer Referral Service, have a half an hour consultation, and get to have some confidence as to what you think the future may be. I'm glad you called. All right. I think, Marianne, you will be our last caller. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Oh, good. Okay.
Hi. I have a question. This better be good, Marianne.
I have a question about, I'm an applicant, I'm blind. Mm. And I'm also a teacher of the visually impaired. And more I'm seeing that all the district advertisement, they advertise for teachers of the visually impaired. Since those jobs are itinerant, they say that the applicants need driver's licenses. And I'm wondering about the legality of that.
John, go ahead.
If the position is one for which driving is part of the job, is an essential function, then having a valid license would be a permissible requirement. But if the person is, what is the position you're applying for?
In general, teacher of the visually impaired going to the different schools.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I like that case that you're articulating because it sounds like they have a policy that is that may not be lawful because, you know, what they're considering to be an essential function of the job, driving, is not an essential function of the job of teacher ordinarily. So, mm-hmm. I mean, every situation is different, but you're not applying for the job of truck driver. You're applying for the job of teacher. Yeah. So the essential functions of the job of teacher, it would seem to me, are things like, are you able to impart learning to the children? You able to, you know, so...
A lot of districts are saying that they want people to get to the different schools on time, etc., because sometimes the schools are very far apart from each other.
Yeah, it's not an easy question. I mean, that's actually a fairly complicated question of disability law, I think, that you've raised.
And I think it would be worthwhile raising with the employer whether or not there's any ability to provide you some form of accommodation that would enable them to move you from job to job. That may well be a reasonable accommodation, in which case requiring that you drive, if you're unable to do so, may not be appropriate.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we have run out of time. I want to thank you very much for joining us on the program. You know, I find that frequently the programs we do, an hour is certainly not enough when we are doing a live program. In any event, thank you very much for joining us. Brian Schwartz, great to have you back on the program. And John Hyland, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
First time
us.
Here on the program. Hope to have both of you back in the not-too-distant future.
Thanks, Chuck.
Your Legal Rights production staff members are program engineer Joanne Marr and production assistant Martin McLean. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar of California. Additional funding is provided by the Trusts and State Section of the State Bar. The Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. If you are wondering about getting some health coverage through the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, next week that's what we're going to be talking about, actually focusing on businesses and employees and trying to figure out what does California or what does covered California do for you. My guests will be employment law attorney Theodora Lee and Mark Herbert, project and outreach manager of Small Business Majority. That's next week. Thank you very much for joining us on Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. Uh-huh.